Okay. Good morning, everyone. We'll start with the second day of this meeting. Our first speaker this morning is Tom Banks, and he'll tell us about holography and cosmology.
Thank you, Herman. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me. At their instructions, I'm going to be sprinkling the vision thing throughout the talk, so you won't be able to tell the difference between the vision part and the rest of the talk. Much of what I'm going to be talking about is based on joint work with Willy Fischler. A lot of it is an extension of a paper that we published this winter. The basic idea is to try to use the holographic principle, following the seminal work of Fischler and Susskind and Raphael Busso, to use the holographic principle to start thinking about cosmology in a quantum mechanical sense and try to make connections between cosmology and M-theory and string theory. The most important thing, the thing that I think you should take out of this talk, if you take nothing else, is that the holographic principle, as it was formulated in the cosmological context by Fischler and Susskind, and then particularly the generalization of it by Busso, gives you a map between the data of at least Big Bang spacetimes into quantum mechanics. So what I'd like you to do is think about your favorite Lorentzian geometry, satisfying the positive energy conditions, and construct what I'd like to call a Planck lattice. Choose a set of coordinates, go out along that set of coordinates, make a simplicial lattice, one Planck distance in length along this particular set of coordinates. At each point of that lattice, choose the backward light cone. Assume you're in a Big Bang spacetime so that there's a finite space-like slice in the past from which everything starts. Think about all of those light cones, and think about all of the intersections of those light cones. The intersections of two light cones, something you can't draw on a two-dimensional piece of paper, I'm sorry, even if you put it right side up, is the intersection of two light cones is not generally a light cone, but there will be a largest light cone that fits inside of it. And the Busso bound on areas in general Lorentzian spacetimes allows you to associate a number with each of those light cones, each of the original light cones and each of the light cones we stuck into the intersections. And that number is supposed to be a bound on the entropy in that region. And it's reasonable to suppose that that bound can be saturated. And so what I'd like you to think of that bound as is a count of the number of quantum states of the system that can be associated with that particular region of spacetime. And it's a finite number. And so what it does is it gives you a way of mapping.
I already have a question about your Planck lattice. Do I have to think about all those squares as Planck size?
Well, the distances between the points are Planck distance, space-like and time-like.
But in a curved space, if I take the fast light cone, if I do it on one slice,
yes,
and I then take fast light cone, do I still get, is that time? Do I have to think about that direction?
You,
because if I have redshift or blue shifts, I don't see how Planck lattice remains a Planck lattice.
I'm not sure exactly what you're saying. I'm just saying, choose a set of coordinates, map out a Planck distance in the metric of space-time along those coordinate axes. At each time, map out a Planck distance from each point, make a lattice.
But then the 45 degrees lines do not need to be light.
Sorry? No, the lattice is not the 45 degree lines. At each of those points, look at the backward light cone. That's always 45 degree lines. The picture was not a picture of the lattice, but it was a picture of the light cones whose tips are sitting at the points of the lattice.
Space-like lattice, a single space-like lattice.
No, arbitrary space-time lattice. Okay. There are a bunch of events in space-time.
Then you might have had more lines needed if the space-time was curved.
Absolutely. This was supposed to be a pictorial representation rather than accurately representing a particular geometry.
Okay.
So there is then, I claim, that the data contained in the areas of all of those light cones and the light cones that fit into their intersections is enough to completely determine the Lorentzian geometry. And what the holographic principle does is it gives you a way of mapping that data into statements about quantum mechanical Hilbert spaces, dimensions of quantum mechanical Hilbert spaces, and which Hilbert spaces fit inside of other Hilbert spaces as tensor factors. Namely, whenever I have a situation like this, where there's one light cone which is sitting inside the intersection of two, the only sense that it makes to me to think of some set of states or degrees of freedom that are associated with this region as opposed to anything else in the spacetime is to say that the Hilbert space of this larger region that contains it should be a tensor product of a Hilbert space that I associate with that intersection and something else. And similarly, any other region that contains that same thing. And so you get a set of relations between Hilbert spaces of this type that each basic Hilbert space that isn't an intersection is writable as an intersection, a possible intersection with every other basic Hilbert space, and then you can do multiple intersections and so on. And there are a bunch of obvious rules for making the multiple intersections consistent with each other that you can write down and which we did talk about in the paper. So what I'm saying to you is that the data of Lorentzian spacetimes can be given a quantum mechanical language, a quantum mechanical interpretation. And so this is the most visionary thing, I think, that I'm going to say. My vision of what the future of this field is going to look like is that we're going to find rules that are formulated purely in quantum mechanical terms and that enable us to deal with nets of finite dimensional Hilbert spaces like this, which, when we take the limit of those rules, as the dimensions of all the Hilbert spaces get large, approach the rules that say that this is a Lorentzian geometry and that the Einstein tensor satisfies the positive energy condition. Yes? Let me come to that question later. Please. Let me come to that question later. So what I'm not asking you to think about this construction for a particular spacetime. I'm just telling you, as the fundamental object, I'm just telling you how this construction allows you to associate this sort of a Hilbert space construction with a particular spacetime. I want us to eventually think of the Hilbert space construction as the fundamental thing from which the dynamics of spacetime will come out. Now, just as an aside, I've thought a little bit about infinite spacetimes like asymptotically flat or asymptotically ADS, and I think it may be that the right way to deal with those is to think about causal diamonds. You take past intersection regions. Oh, by the way, this acronym, which I hate, PIRS, past intersection region, is thought of as one of these regions that you get by multiply intersecting some number of backward light cones. Future intersection region is, of course, the opposite of that. And if you think about the intersection of a pyre and a fire, then you get a causal diamond. And even in an infinite spacetime, that'll have a finite entropy associated with it. So it may be that that's the basic way to think about infinite spacetimes, but I haven't thought about that very much. So I don't have these rules. I wish I could give them to you. But what I want to talk about today is things that you can say about spacetime that I think will follow from any reasonable set of rules. And in particular, I think we can say some interesting things about the very initial state, which is the following. As you go back into the past, you're taking intersections. In the Hilbert space sense, that means that you're looking at smaller and smaller tensor factors. At some point, you have to stop. You get to a Hilbert space that has a prime dimension. Now, I want you to realize that any construction of the type that I'm talking about depended, and I showed you quite explicitly how it depended, on a choice of coordinates. And so it's not unique in any way, and you might find bad choices. And I think that ending up with only large primes is a bad choice of coordinates. If you think about the geometry of a sensible choice of coordinates in a Big Bang spacetime, then when you go back far enough, all of the particle horizons get arbitrarily small. And you should imagine, I think, then, that it's always possible to go back and choose things in such a way that the smallest dimension of Hilbert space you get to is the smallest possible dimension there is, namely 2. Now that implies that the initial state of the universe is effectively unique up to a gauge transformation, because if I have an initial state that's a bunch of disjoint two-state systems, and the state is a tensor product in that tensor product Hilbert space, then it doesn't really make sense to distinguish who's up and who's down independently in the different places. The physics later on is going to be related to the physics at that point by some unitary transformation. A unitary evolution in the theory of quantum gravity is quite clearly not uniquely defined. This is the so-called problem of time in general relativity. There's no way to choose a particular special coordinate system where the time evolution is unique. And so the choice of the initial state effectively gets put into that ambiguity in the choice of what your time evolution is. And so you can just decide to say, by convention, that all of the initial states are, quote, spin up, and the initial state is unique. Now, Ed, I think the idea that the initial state is unique goes back to Ed, though I think for probably somewhat different reasons than this. And I'm not sure how much it buys us, because the real problem that we have in talking about physics at this point is precisely the problem of time. We don't know in general relativity how to define a special time evolution operator on the Hilbert space. The only way we know how to do that is when we have a space that's infinite, has an asymptotic boundary, we can define special generators of diffeomorphisms that act only on the boundary, that act on the Hilbert space, and those are our special Hamiltonians that define what we mean by time. When we're working in a very quantum mechanical region of space-time, where really space-time doesn't quite exist in any standard geometric sense, I don't think we really know what it means to make a unique choice of what the time evolution operator is. So the first place that I know how to say something sensible is if I imagine that my hypothesis is right, and that we can set up some set of rules for nets of Hilbert space like this, which will, once the Hilbert spaces get large enough, describe little patches of space-time, let me do the following thing. Let me define time slices partially, at least in the following way. I'll always define a time slice such that the tips of the light cones on any particular slice are all light cones that have equal Busso area. Okay. So for large enough area, there are a lot of states inside a given backward light cone, and I expect that I can have a semi-classical space-time description of the physics inside of that backward light cone. So now there will be some kind of background geometry, which, since I'm looking at a fairly small region, is locally at least going to be reasonably flat. And that background geometry will have a time coordinate associated with it. It'll be some sort of classical geometry, and I'm trying to think about some kind of a universe which on that scale is homogeneous and has some localized excitations in it. So what's the most probable state of the system that looks like that? Well, there's a very famous bound due to Bekenstein, the generalization of which is the Busso bound that I'm talking about, that says that the most probable state, the way you can pack the most states into a finite region of space-time, and because I'm working with a particular finite-size backward light cone, I do have only a finite region that I can put these states into. There is a maximal mass black hole that I can stick in, where mass is defined by the energy that the time coordinate of this background geometry gives me. And that maximal mass black hole has the highest entropy. Namely, that's the largest number of states associated with a given background geometry. And so I think the reasonable thing to say is that the most probable initial state as I come into this semi-classical era is that in each independent horizon volume, I see the maximal size black hole that I can stick into it. Now that's very nice because that is looked at globally, not from the point of view of an observer in a local horizon volume, but looked at globally over all the horizon volumes. This is a state that is in some sense uniform. The black holes look the same because they're all maximal mass. So if the maximal mass is large enough, the fluctuations around not having the maximal mass will be small, and then the geometry will be very much uniform from place to place. This is an observation that Willy and I originally made in our paper based on something else that was said in the original Fischler-Susskind paper. If you look at equations of state for homogeneous isotropic cosmologies, and you look at whether or not you can saturate the holographic bound or be consistent with the holographic bound, the limiting equation of state for which you can be consistent with the holographic bound to arbitrarily small times is the P equals rho equation of state, the same one that's picked out by causality as the limiting place where the speed of sound equals the speed of light. And it was observed in the Fischler-Susskind paper, and then Willy and I emphasized this strongly in our paper, that that state enabled you to saturate the entropy of the universe with a homogeneous gas. And so that looked like a solution of the horizon problem. It explained homogeneity, but without any special initial conditions. Now, when we talked about that previously, we didn't have a very good physical picture about what this stuff was that had the P equals rho equation of state. What I'd now like to argue to you is that that stuff is precisely a dense gas of black holes. So indeed, if I take a gas of black holes that have a number density n, the energy density is the mass times the number density. The entropy density in d dimensions is given by this formula. I'm leaving out factors of order 1, of course. The Schwarzschild radius is given by the mass to the 1 over d minus 3. And now if I say that the black holes are spaced a distance 1 over the Schwarzschild radius, or 1 over 3 Schwarzschild radii, I find that the entropy density scales like the square root of the energy density. And if I have a thermodynamic system which is uniform and has this relation between entropy density and energy density, then thermodynamics tells me that the equation of state of that system is P equals rho. So a dense gas of black holes is a realization of the P equals rho equation of state and explains the homogeneity of spacetime over horizon volumes that are have never talked to each other. Yes. Yeah, the coefficient out front here depends on the dimension. And it also depends on precisely how many Schwarzschild radii apart you assume the things are. So there's a fixed coefficient in any given dimension if you insist that you exactly saturate the holographic bound. Sorry? Wait. You may ask, you may very well ask, why does it have thermodynamics at all? Why is it in equilibrium? Okay. Well, yes. So how does this black hole gas actually evolve? Does it remain in equilibrium with P equals rho? What happens? So if you can think about various processes that can occur. There are three that you think of immediately. One of them is completely negligible at this early time. Namely, as black holes come into each other's horizon, they can merge with each other and form larger black holes. As black holes come into each other's horizon, the universe is expanding, they can separate from each other. That would, if that was the dominant process, that would lead black holes to behave like a P equals zero gas, rather than a P equals rho gas. And finally, you might imagine that black holes decay into radiation and you'd get P equals a third rho. At these early times, that's very unlikely because the black holes are all very close to each other. There's no reason for them to be emitting photons. Photons emitted by one black hole will be absorbed by another one. That's not a dominant process early on. The big problem that we don't know how to solve is to understand the competition between those two processes of merger and expansion. We believe that the merger loses, that the merger is in unstable equilibrium, because you can, let's assume that the merger keeps on going and is maximally efficient, and the universe expands by a scale factor A, and let's count how many black holes had to merge by the time the universe expanded by a scale factor capital A in order to keep up this P equals rho equation of state with exactly the same relation between entropy and energy density. And you need A to the ninth. I've now gone just to four space-time dimensions at this point, and I will continue in four space-time dimensions from this point on. You need A to the ninth black holes to merge over a period of expansion by scale factor A. It seems to us that that's unlikely to happen with tremendous efficiency. And anytime there's a little gap, anytime that there's a region with lower energy density, then they tend to separate. You get a P equals zero gas, the universe expands faster. And so there seems to be an instability that sets in there. That process of determining how the P equals rho gas evolves, and we believe that the way it will evolve eventually is to a P equals zero gas, that's going to be complicated to work out. You might worry, and I do worry, that it might lead to a universe that is in no way homogeneous and isotropic, that there are large fluctuations generated by this process. I don't know the answer to that. We would hope that the end result of this process is that you get a more or less homogeneous and isotropic universe, but it's clear there are going to be some fluctuations, and the fascinating problem is to calculate that fluctuation spectrum. And I think probably most of you know why. That's an interesting problem. So what do we have here? We have a picture of the beginning of the universe, which I claim follows fairly naturally just from the holographic principle and the principles of quantum mechanics and thermodynamics. And this picture of the beginning of the universe leads me to at least the possibility, it leads me to a calculation which I haven't done yet, but let me, bear with me, and let us assume that this calculation gives us the desired result. You get a nice fluctuation spectrum, not too big, maybe even scale invariant with the right size, etc. So a question that you might ask yourself, given this, is do we need inflation? Now don't get me wrong, I like inflation very much. I think inflation is a very beautiful idea. Nonetheless, we see the possibility here that there might be an alternative. And we've started thinking about all of the different problems that inflation is supposed to solve for us, and whether this scenario can solve them as well. Now, the crucial question is, what happens to the fluctuation spectrum? Do I really get a more or less homogeneous universe with small fluctuations? And are those fluctuations of the right scale invariant form? So you have to let me alone for that, because I don't have that information. We're thinking about it. We're working on it. But let's think about some of the other problems. One of the famous problems that led Alan Guth to start thinking about inflation was the monopole problem. How does the monopole problem look in this context? So first of all, let's think about that very primordial state, the first time I thought about the universe as really a geometry, a space-time, and ask, where are the monopoles going to come from? What are they going to be? Well, the only thing that they can be is that some of those black holes, which are taking up everything in each horizon volume, might be charged black holes. If we're given mass, that is a not such a probable thing, because the entropy of a black hole goes down as you add charge to it at fixed mass. it's not too bad. It's not, you know, something that is exponential in the mass, but it's exponential in the charge. And so you get an a priori probability that the charge is suppressed by e to the minus 2 pi q squared. So that's a number that's of order 10 to the minus 3. That's nowhere near enough to solve the monopole problem. But the really interesting thing that happens is this merger phase. So what's happening during this merger phase, where the black holes are still merging and we haven't yet gotten into unstable equilibrium? Remember, capital A is the scale factor between the beginning of the semi-classical universe and the time the merger phase ends and we get into a p equals zero phase, hopefully. What is going to happen? Well, if you think about the process of the black holes merging together, you can see that during that process, the number of monopoles per black hole remains constant. But you still have this 10 to the minus 3 factor after the merger phase. Each of the much larger black holes that has formed remains with about the same charge. There are pluses and minuses. They all come together. The entropy is again dominated by making the smallest charge possible. Zero is not that probable, so you get only the 10 to the minus 3 suppression. But now let's go on a little further into the evolution of the universe, assuming that, as I said, our universe starts to evolve as a p equals zero gas of black holes. With what mass? Well, it's whatever their initial mass was, expanded by this merger factor. You had to merge a to the ninth black holes if the p equals rho phase lasted for scale factor A. So you can then calculate from that what the Hawking decay of the black holes into massless stuff is going to look like, and in particular, what temperature, when the black holes have all essentially decayed, what temperature the black holes are going to reheat the universe to. Okay, that's straightforward. You plug in the lifetime according to the Hawking formula. You plug in the formula for the reheat temperature in terms of the lifetime that you find in Turner and Kolb. You worry a little bit about whether the calculation is applicable to black holes, but I think it is. And you find that the number of photons per black hole is large. Why? Because the black hole masses, if A is large, the black hole masses have gotten very large. Their Hawking temperature is low. Their decay rate is slow. The universe redshifts a lot. And the actual factor is that the number of photons, and then you're producing these sort of low energy photons because the reheat temperature is low because of the redshift. And so each black hole turned into a lot of those low energy photons. And you get 8 to the 15 halves photons per black hole. And the reheat temperature is 8 to the minus 9 halves times M Planck. And all of this was done with the assumption that the primordial black hole I started with was of order the Planck size. And that's probably not realistic. I probably should have started out somewhat larger than the Planck size in order to really believe that I could do semi-classical physics. So there's an unknown factor there coming from that initial condition, which actually improves this particular calculation. So what you find is, if you run this through and now say, how many monopoles does this give me at late stages of the universe, during nucleosynthesis, during galaxy formation, etc., it looks like you need A to be about 10 to the 3 in order to explain the monopole problem. The number of monopoles per photon gets smaller and smaller the larger A is. And if the original black holes are larger than Planck mass, this gets reduced. Okay, because the mass started out larger, the Hawking temperature started out lower, etc. So that's for the monopole problem. Again, really solving it depends on what A is, what the initial conditions are. We don't yet understand that transition region between p equals rho and p equals zero enough to really tell you the answer to that question, but it might be solved in this context. Now, what about another famous problem, the flatness problem, the one that is everybody loves to talk about, how omega is so close to one. I think that the flatness problem, and now I'm really going to get myself into trouble, I think the flatness problem is a relic of the infancy of cosmology. When cosmology started out, we made this assumption about, not we, but or predecessors made this assumption about homogeneous isotropic universes, and there were these three choices, and there's this parameter, what the curvature is initially. But in the context I'm talking about here, and I believe in any sensible discussion that carries over the concept of particle horizon into the exact description of the theory, it doesn't really make sense to talk about the global spatial structure of the universe at early times. The universe is made up of these little systems that never talk to each other. If you believe in the concept of particle horizon, again, I want to emphasize to you one of the most important things about the work of Fischler and Susskind and Busso was that they showed that the holographic principle is compatible with the concept of particle horizon, even though we normally think of particle horizon as being derived from locality and holography is, you know, in great contrast with locality. The holographic principle is compatible with the concept of particle horizon, and in fact, I think in this construction I've told you about, that's the way local kind of physics happens in a holographic universe. So what is the flatness problem? Well, should I be talking about the global curvature at all? I don't think so. I should sort of trying to talk about the local spatial curvatures in each of these horizon volumes and how they fit together. Now, again, I don't have what I would call a solution to that problem as yet, but it just seems to me it has to be framed in a completely different way, and the standard omega equals one is a great triumph for inflation and was a great problem for the Big Bang, came because we assumed we were talking about homogeneous isotropic universes and they had a certain global shape. And I just don't think that's the right way to talk about cosmology. So local fluctuations of curvature we always think of as related to the matter fluctuations by Einstein's equations, and that's a problem that we can try to discuss. Is there some way in which local curvatures like to build up to make a global curvature? I think the answer to that is probably not, but we don't know. So at this point, let me say something else bad about inflation before I conclude this. The one thing that you might be bothered about with inflation in a holographic universe, if you believe in the holographic principle and if you believe that there's a non-zero cosmological constant, is the following. If there's a non-zero cosmological constant today, if the thing we've been seeing is evidence for a non-zero cosmological constant, then our current particle horizon doesn't get too much bigger. And it just goes out a little bit more and it becomes the cosmological horizon, and that's all you ever see. But most models of inflation, especially the ones that are most favored by most of the inflation theorists, invoke many, many, many e-foldings of inflation such that the inflated era is many, many times, orders of magnitude, many orders of magnitude larger than our current horizon volume. And therefore, from the point of view of the holographic principle, those models are all talking about physics that somehow you can never, ever measure if we're talking about a universe that ultimately has a cosmological constant of the size we seem to be seeing today. And that makes me uncomfortable. So, okay. Nonetheless, I told you I like inflation. There's this famous government organization, the CYA, and here's the CYA's motto. If we do need inflation, M-theory can have inflation using moduli. I've written lots of papers about that. So I'll fall back on modular cosmology if we do need inflation. If there's holography and there's a non-zero cosmological constant of the magnitude we seem to be seeing today, then most inflationary models are talking about physics that will never be measured. Yes, these are inflationary models where there are many, many e-foldings. If you have just 60, more or less, just enough, which most inflation theorists tell me, that's not good because you don't get the right spectrum of fluctuations if you don't have many more. I'm not sure whether that's true, but if it's true, then that would say that those models that fit the data are invoking regions of space-time that we will never, ever see. And that makes me uncomfortable. But nonetheless, I like inflation enough that I'm quite willing, if none of this works, to go back and say that inflation. Sorry? A number of E-foldings such that the inflationary patch fills up the cosmological horizon is fine. Sorry?
Since we can see the rest, inflation on cosmology is going to be on the same.
Yes. Okay, well, let's see what time it is. Yeah. Well, I think that's enough whining about the past. Let's talk about what I call the desperate future. So I've talked to you a lot in recent conferences, or to many of you, about what I think about de Sitter space and the fact that I believe that an asymptotically de Sitter space has a finite number of quantum states associated with it. That's this same holographic counting that I've been invoking throughout this talk. And more recently, we've realized that that means that there's no gauge invariant S matrix concept in asymptotically de Sitter spaces. There's nothing like the kind of things we think we know how to calculate in string theory, which depend for their existence and gauge invariance on an asymptotic infinite boundary of the universe where the geometry is frozen into a particular shape. So I'm not going to talk too much about those details. Willie is going to be giving a talk on the last day of this conference in which he'll talk a lot about that stuff. I'll leave that to him. I want to remind you of a conjecture that I made. Let me hide this part of the transparency. Supersymmetry breaking, as we see it in local particle physics today, is actually due to this fact that we're living in a de Sitter space rather than an asymptotically Minkowski space. And the main burden of that conjecture is that the scaling of the gravitino mass with the cosmological constant, as the cosmological constant goes to zero, is different than the one we get from classical supergravity. The other, of course, very important turnaround of the way we think about this problem is that if the finite number of states is actually the thing that's being measured by the cosmological constant, I claim that that is not what we've always thought it to be, a parameter to be calculated, but a fundamental input. And so we shouldn't be thinking about calculating lambda in terms of the scale of Susy breaking masses, but calculating the scale of Susy breaking masses in terms of lambda. And then the problem is that the power law is wrong as lambda goes to zero, all these formulas being in Planck units. Now, there's no positive evidence for that conjecture whatsoever, but what I'd like to convince you of is that you don't know how to do this calculation in any reliable way. So first of all, let me talk just about the standard supergravity formula for the gravitino mass. It's given in terms of the superpotential, which determines the F terms, and the Kähler potential. And let me remind you that in every theory we know, the Kähler potential gets logarithmically divergent ultraviolet corrections, including from gravitational loops, which we don't understand at all. And we don't know how to calculate that formula with quantum corrections put into it. Yes? Excuse me?
In string theory.
In string theory, you can't give me an example of a de Sitter vacuum. And I think you wrote a paper about that. And so we can't talk about the question. Sorry? Well, you certainly can't calculate the Kähler potential due to energies above the Planck scale. Okay. And that, as you'll see, is what's relevant, I believe, for the actual calculation of this. Now, I've previously made statements about what I thought the mechanism might be for this enhancement, and I want to retract some of those. Or rather to say that I don't think I previously identified what is, I believe, the dominant contribution. When you think about de Sitter space, you can think about black holes in de Sitter space. and you can think about the maximal entropy you can put into a localized state in De Sitter space, and there's this maximal size black hole. And that was an important part of understanding that De Sitter space had a finite entropy, that there was a maximal size black hole you could stick into it. But in fact, when you calculate the entropy of that black hole, it's not equal to the entropy of De Sitter space. It's only two-thirds or a third, depending on whether you count both of its horizons or one. And I think what that means, and I think it's very clear why this is true, is that most of the entropy in De Sitter space should not be thought of as having to do with black hole states that can be formed in the bulk of De Sitter space, but with states that live on the boundary of the horizon. And once you think about De Sitter space in the global way that people always like to think about it, I think that also becomes clear. Because from that point of view, what happens to most of the stuff in the universe is it goes out through your cosmological horizon. The black hole complementarity principle, or its generalization, the cosmological complementarity principle, says that it should be possible to describe that physics as observed by an observer in a given horizon in terms of a system on the horizon and local physics inside the horizon. Or, if you wish, you can choose the whole holographic screen for everything to be the horizon, but then you're making local physics look very obscure. So, let me talk about the problem of SUSY breaking in a little bit more generality. A couple of the things that led me to this, I just want to remind you of them, because when I talk to people, I find that they haven't sunk in. I think that one important piece of evidence is that, try as we might, we have never found an example of a stable, asymptotically flat version of M theory, string theory, what have you, which has vacua with broken supersymmetry. Every single time we try to break supersymmetry, we get instabilities, and they don't lead to asymptotically flat space-times. No. There are, supersymmetry is broken, but there are moduli, there's a potential. You don't get an asymptotically flat space. So, as I said, the Bekenstein-Hawking formula identifies lambda as a fundamental parameter. The cosmological constant problem and the problem of finding asymptotically flat theories with broken supersymmetry suggests to me that asymptotically flat theories don't have broken supersymmetry, and that supersymmetry must be preserved in order to have an asymptotically flat spacetime. We know of lots of supersymmetric asymptotically flat vacua, none that are asymptotically flat and not supersymmetric. I believe that's associated with the very rapidly rising spectrum of black hole states in asymptotically flat vacua, and one could make analogies with a thing that was done in perturbative string theory by Kutaisoff and Seiberg, where they showed that the Hagedorn spectrum of perturbative string theory leads you to almost exact supersymmetry if you want to avoid instability. The black hole spectrum in asymptotically flat spacetime rises much more rapidly than the Hagedorn spectrum. I think there might be some tests of these ideas within the ADS-CFT correspondence. The challenge there is to find a non-supersymmetric ADS-CFT example, one which I believe those exist for sure, one in which you can also tune the radius of the ADS space to infinity and try to get a flat space limit. And then one can study in that context how large the breaking of supersymmetry really is quantum mechanically as I take r to zero. In the unstable examples of these things that we have, you always find that as you take the ADS radius to infinity, SUSY is restored. The classical formula for how fast it's restored is just like the classical formula for the gravitino mass in De Sitter space. The question is that true quantum mechanically? Can we get a handle on that problem? It's not exactly the same problem as De Sitter space, but you should think of asymptotically anti-De Sitter space as sort of a smooth regulator of the growth of black hole states in asymptotically flat space, where in a context in which I think of De Sitter space as a sharp cutoff an ADS is sort of a smooth regulator that changed the black hole degeneracy formula at a certain parameter, which is the radius associated with the anti-de Sitter space. Just to suggest some problems to people who are interested. But now, to get to my main point here, I think really that the mechanism we should be thinking about, if we're going to get a local space-time picture of at all of what's going on in this cosmological supersymmetry breaking, is that the dominant set of states is near the horizon. We should be thinking about radiative corrections due to interactions with the states on the horizon. And now I want to ask you, in local field theory, why do you think that's small? And the reason that you think that's small, if I think about just quantum field theory in a space with a boundary someplace far away, and I ask for the renormalization of some local particle mass due to the existence of that boundary, it's not zero, but it's exponentially small because the loops have propagators in them that have to go out this large space-like distance, and the loops have masses or momentum cutoffs, and so they fall off exponentially. Is that good enough to make a small effect in de Sitter space? Well, here's a cartoon of what the calculation might look like. Here's a cartoon in which what I've done is said a particle has traveled out to a coordinate y. This is in the static coordinate system of de Sitter space, where y equals r is the de Sitter cosmological horizon. The geodesic distance is given by this formula here. So this is the suppression of due to the particle's propagator. There's also power law on top of that. But let's just talk about the exponentials, even though the answer you want to come out in the end has a power law in it, so you have to be more delicate than this. Now what happens? Well, there are lots of states in the system. They're of order e to the m squared states if I go out some distance of order m, and I can go out up to a distance of order r. So I sort of have to integrate over density of states with a e to the m squared factor. That's of course dominated by the states on the horizon, as I said to you. Now, why does that normally not affect calculations in de Sitter space? Well, if y is near the origin, then there's also a temperature factor in de Sitter space. If I think of the Hamiltonian as the standard static de Sitter Hamiltonian, there's a temperature factor, and the Hawking temperature of de Sitter space is such that even with this large degeneracy of states, at near the origin, that's completely suppressed by the Boltzmann factor. The Boltzmann factor dominates. It gives an e to the minus 2 r squared suppression near the origin. But as you all know, as you approach the horizon of a black hole or of de Sitter space, and if you're a local person who's using the static coordinates that live only up to the horizon, the effective temperature goes up. And the closer you get to the horizon, the more of the states of the horizon you can excite. And if you look at this formula, if you could get all the way to the horizon, this suppression factor would go away. This one would still be there, but it would be beaten by this e to the r squared factor. So that's much too large an answer. That could only be consistent with getting a non-large answer if the gravitino mass, in fact, increased as r went to infinity, like r. So I think that there's probably some kind of additional suppression factor that we haven't yet understood of the localized particle states in their interaction with states on the horizon. They have to go out to the horizon, interact, and come back. And that probably introduces another suppression factor that I don't know how to calculate. And I doubt that anybody else does at this point. But what I'd like to make of this formula is the answer is unknown. The naive answer is actually big, not small. And so you need to understand the calculation in much greater detail in order to understand how big an effect you get from interaction with states on the horizon. And of course, there's a nice answer that fits with phenomenology, which is the one that I told you about. Now, I think I've run over my time, is that right? Okay. Yeah, I was thinking about whether to tell you about some very preliminary stuff that I've been doing about taking the limit from De Sitter space to Minkowski space and how we would understand how M-theory really comes out in the cosmological constant goes to zero limit in view of the time and in view of the shaky nature of the material. I think I will back off on that and take questions at this point.
Okay, are there questions? I'll microphone for the questions.
Hi. With your very interesting initial condition, you discussed whether we would still need inflation. Recently, there's been another sort of alternative to inflation, which is the big splat, right? Which is has an initial condition in which you have two brains, which have been static for almost all eternity, and are about to collide. Is your story? Are these connected?
These are not connected in any way.
Are they consistent?
They are not consistent with each other.
And do they have different observational predictions?
Almost certainly, but I don't know what the observational predictions of mine are yet. Yes. No. I refuse to say the argument. I have had private discussions with Paul Steinhardt about this, and I'm waiting for an answer for him. And so okay, and you know, there are people more expert than I in the audience on this subject, so I think I will beg off there.
So I was confused by comparing the first part of your talk to the second part. The first part you were talking about a gas of black holes, but then in the second part you said that black holes actually don't dominate in De Sitter space. You have to really think about the degrees of freedom on the horizon. How are these two points of view?
Well, they're very different times in the history of the universe. The gas of black holes is an appropriate initial condition for a Big Bang universe, and I think it is the generic initial condition. Then I believe that it's unstable into decay into a sort of matter-dominated universe where the matter is still the black holes, but they're no longer densely packed and they're not merging all the time. They're just kind of sitting there and expanding with the universe. Then they decay by Hawking radiation into the empty space that's been created about them. Okay. Much later on, you get into this De Sitter space when you've exhausted all of the states there are in the universe, when the particle horizon has gotten out to be the cosmological horizon. That's when the De Sitter phase occurs. So it's just a different state of the world, and at that later state, it's not the localized black holes that are carrying most of the entropy, but states that have gone out through the horizon.
But wait, I thought we have a finite number of degrees of freedom all the time. So
yes.
How do you get from something that's not De Sitter to something that is
Einstein's equations give you a very natural way to do this, right? You have, okay, so. Now, you have a finite number of degrees of freedom in, I'm not sure I'm understanding your question exactly. I mean, The finite number of degrees of freedom is huge compared to the number inside a particle horizon at early times. Okay. So the system which has a particle horizon, which is then going to merge with other particle horizons and complicated physics is going on, that's nothing like De Sitter space, even though it initially has a finite number of states associated with it. The evolution law, I mean, fairy tale quantum evolution law that I told you about that will become Einstein's equations in the large dimension, Hilbert space dimension limit, that should give you the same results of Einstein's equations. And Einstein's equations say that if I have a non-P equals minus rho universe that has other stuff in it, that the other stuff dominates at early times, and then you eventually get into the De Sitter phase. And the De Sitter phase is sort of when you've seen everything there is to see.
I wanted to comment on Eva's question briefly. The question whether black holes are, I mean, having black holes or not having black holes, which of these is more favorable, depends on whether there's a cosmological horizon present at that time. If you do have a cosmological horizon present, then putting a black hole in means that you actually decrease the overall entropy. But if there's no cosmological horizon present, then putting a black hole in means increasing the total entropy because you don't pay by a smaller cosmological horizon. But I think your question could be translated into asking if the argument for what the initial state is has to do with what is the highest entropy, and if you do have a positive cosmological constant, why don't you just start with empty de Sitter space, which surely must have the highest possible entropy since that is later reached anyway?
Well, because the total number of states is much larger than the state, the number in any given particle horizon. So the evolution law that corresponds to empty de Sitter space is when you find that your Hilbert spaces just can't get any bigger. All right. Now, if I have a large cosmological constant and it's really a cosmological constant, then there are no regions that get causally connected. There's one de Sitter horizon, that's the whole universe, and we shouldn't talk about anything outside that horizon.
So you always measure the total number of degrees of freedom initially, and basically
yes.
Say what the data are in my plot.
Yeah, by the way, I should point out to you, there's another cosmological conundrum that this way of looking at things sheds light on. Normally, one of the things, again, that inflation is supposed to explain to you is the fact that if I follow a standard Big Bang back from our current situation, and I ask when the universe gets to Planckian energy densities in the standard Big Bang, how big is the volume of the region that is going to become our current horizon volume? And its linear size is 10 to the 27 Planck lengths. So there's a large number. In this way of looking at that thing, at that situation, that number is effectively, again, measuring the cosmological constant. The total number, you need that many regions to fit in all the entropy that the system is eventually going to see.
I have a...
That's something like 10 more fingers. We have one more question. Tom will have a busy day answering the other questions.
Well, in ordinary field theory, you can't assign a Hilbert space to a region of space. So I'm a little bit surprised that you hope to do so in quantum gravity, where even the notion of a region of space is vague because of fluctuations in the geometry. I would have thought that your idea of a Hilbert space associated with a region was a kind of semi-classical approximation that made sense when the Hilbert space was big. But I found that it's very surprising when you took that notion so literally that you discussed seriously whether the dimension of the Hilbert space was prime.
Okay. There are so many parts to this question. First of all, in standard quantum field theory, if I take double cone regions, then I do associate actually an operator algebra rather than a Hilbert space just to those regions. And then there are questions about the Hilbert space, the operator
well,
algebra.
It's a very crucial point that
always infinite dimensional in that case.
Well, you can't associate a Hilbert space to the region. There is an operator algebra, but not a Hilbert space.
Right, but that problem is avoided by having things that are always finite dimensional. If you have finite dimensional operator algebras, there's a unique Hilbert space representation. Okay.
That's a correct mathematical statement.
So the crucial feature that the Big Bang plays in this is that even if you don't have a de Sitter space eventually in the future so that the total number of states is finite, at any finite point after the Big Bang, you never have to talk about a Hilbert space that has more than finite dimension. And so the dichotomy between operator algebras and Hilbert spaces is not there. Okay. The formalism that it may be a little bit much to call it a formalism because it's not really developed, but the formalism that I'm kind of sketching for you in an impressionistic way is taking very literally this connection between the entropy and the dimension of the Hilbert space in an extremely literal way. And I think you gain a lot of things by it, and it's a conjecture. I'm not claiming that I can prove that that's true. I think it's a very, to my mind, a very nice way to understand how local physics can be compatible with holography.
We have to move on at this point. So we'll go to our next speaker, that's Greg Moore.
And let's thank Tom again.
Where's Greg?